Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Purdy Insurance. Visit Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury or visit online at purdyinsurance.com. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to have you with us, and today's show brought to you by our good friends at Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Purdy's have served the Valley for decades, finding their customers the right insurance, whether it's auto, home, life, business, and they also search for the best price. And if there's a claim, they go to work as if it happened to them. That's because they're your partner in all this. It's Purdy Insurance. Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Well, Gabe Kapler didn't have to make a lot of decisions the other day in a 20-1 game. The call of Scott Fransky in our play-by-play call of the day.
Swing and a high fly. Deep right center field. This one's going to go way, way back, and it is gone. It clears the triangle of stands behind the out-of-town scoreboard and heads on into the bullpens. A tremendous drive by Jorge Alfaro, showing off that power.
Don't have to make any decisions when it's 20-1. No need to warm up anybody. All right. We'll get to Matt Leon, final half hour. Old friend Guy Cipriano joins us from Golf Industry Magazine. Guy, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice, Steve, and it's great to be on.
I want to start with, obviously there's so many elements of the golf industry you deal with. Now, in terms of the players, this is not the single most popular champion in the history of the game by his fellow competitors or by the fans themselves, is it?
No, there might not be a more mysterious or even polarizing figure in the world of golf than Patrick Reed. You figure he's 27 years old. He has played in two Ryder Cups, including a winning Ryder Cup team. He now has five PGA Tour wins, a major championship, a WGC win, a FedEx playoff win. He's been as high as eighth in the world. And you start hearing the chatter after the tournament yesterday, and everyone's talking about Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler, who actually won the tournament. So what does that tell you about his popularity? His background is really mysterious. No one quite knows his family history. No one quite knows a lot about Patrick himself, besides the fact that he's a real feisty competitor who seems to rise to big occasions like he did yesterday. This is a guy that really should be embraced when you consider the way he plays golf and what he's accomplished at such a young age and what he's done representing his country. But it's almost like Danny Willett won the Masters again yesterday in his own country.
And what's interesting is that Reed is, with his fellow competitors, he's not very popular, although Ricky Fowler, with complete clash yesterday, greeted him when he was going to sign his scorecard.
And Bubba Watson, another polarizing figure, was one of the first players there to greet him.
That's exactly right. I mentioned that earlier. Bubba is not very popular among his fellow competitors, but Reed is one of those guys that I can understand inside the ropes. Look, if you don't want to interact because you're trying to concentrate on what you're doing, I get that. But he's the kind of guy that once he's done with all of you.
Yeah, and we don't know why, because we don't know a lot about him. He doesn't open up like some of the other players do. The guy is on TV a lot. I mean, he's played over 30 tournaments the last 4 years, Steve. That's a lot of golf for a high-profile player, a guy who plays all over the world. So it is the type of guy that you see a lot on TV, you should know about, but he's got this facade around him. He's obviously really, really tight with his in-laws. He's got no relationship whatsoever with his own family. There's a fascinating story here to be told. I put this out in a tweet today that a Patrick Reed biography that's balanced and accurate and talks to everybody involved that you could possibly get access to would almost be more fascinating than a Tiger Woods biography. This is a guy that we know very little about that could be on the world stage now for a long time.
I think he'll be on the world stage for a long time. I think he might win a major. I think the best quality of his game is that when he has a scent of something, he does have the ability to close. The problem is getting to that point where he gets the scent.
Yeah, and I think something happened at the PGA Championship last August. People forget that he backdoored his way into a second-place finish. Justin Thomas ran away with that tournament on the last four or five holes. But there were a lot of other guys in the mix, like Hideki Matsuyama and Kevin Kisner. And then when you looked at it and it was all said and done at Quail Hollow, Patrick Reed came in second place, which was by far his highest performance ever at a major championship. And I think something happened at Quail Hollow during the weekend, in Sunday in particular, where he made his way toward the top of the leaderboard and passed a lot of players that were even ranked higher than him in the world rankings. I think something clicked at Quail Hollow last August that's going to make him a factor now in many major championships. I'm not going to say he's going to contend for every major championship this year, but I think we'll see his name pop up in at least one or two major championships a year for the next decade, and I think we can attribute that to what happened at the PGA Championship in 2017.
Yeah, that's a good point. Tiger Woods, obviously, what was interesting to me about him is I think that since he's come back, and everything's a prod, there's rungs up the ladder he has to climb to finally get there. I think he'll win a tournament here, but the fact that it's Shinnecock and Carnoustie, those courses don't suit his game when he's playing at his best, let alone trying to come back. His iron play has been great, and I thought the driver would get him because he finally had a tournament where he had to use driver, because they hadn't had tournaments yet where he's had to use driver. He drove the ball really well. It was his irons that let him down.
Here's what we know about Tiger Woods. He tells us after every round that he needs to hit the gym. I'm not sure if he might be more concerned with weightlifting and bodybuilding right now than actually playing golf. And we also know that he can play well on flat Florida golf courses. He's been living in Florida now for a long time, and you look at his two top 10 finishes this year and the two tournaments that he contended in. They were at PGA National in the Honda Classic and at Innisbrook in the Valspar Championship. Well, what are those? Those are flat Florida golf courses. Besides Stream Song, I'm not sure there is a golf course in Florida that has any elevation. So that's kind of the environment he's been practicing and playing in for the last few years when he's been away from the tour and when he's been healthy enough to play and practice. We don't know anything whatsoever how he's going to hold up on a major championship caliber golf course with some terrain and some firmness and some different rolls and bounces, and under that mental pressure where you have to really be physically in shape to go four rounds and mentally in shape to go four rounds. Augusta National was the first was a strenuous walking test, and so was Riviera is a strenuous walk in some places, mm-hmm. where he didn't perform very well, and Torrey Pines has that U.S. Open type layout. So we really don't know how he's going to perform in these major championship environments and on these courses like the ones you mentioned, like Shinnecock and Carnoustie and Bellerive coming up in the PGA Championship. I really don't think we know any more about Tiger Woods than we did before his comeback.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Bellerive's the one unknown. I have no idea whether his game fits Bellerive or not, because I haven't used it in the Rota for anything for a while.
I just don't see a 42-year-old guy that is in so physical shape that can barely bend over to pick a ball out of a golf hole holding up to what could be St. Louis heat in August.
Right, exactly. And I'm going to go off topic for 1 second. How do you feel about the change with moving the players up and moving the PGA into what would be a slot here in the next couple of weeks starting next year?
At first, I was kind of resistant to it because I knew what it would do to the rest of the PGA Tour schedule. Steve, not only is the PGA Championship going up to May, the FedEx playoffs are going to August, and there are going to be some other changes in the tour schedule, including close to home where I live in Northeast Ohio, Firestone, and the WGC Bridgestone isn't going to be part of the PGA Tour schedule anymore. Memphis is going to get that WGC event because of the sponsorship. So at first I was a little resistant to the change because I know that a lot of events that are quality summer events are going to get forced to the fall or a time of year that isn't as desirable, and they're going to struggle finding volunteers and corporate support. And the more volunteers and corporate support you have, the more money you can eventually feed into charity. So it's going to have a negative impact on a lot of other events. But then when you look at it as the PGA Championship as an entity itself and as a major championship, I think it's really going to help that event being away from the start of football, the start of high school sports, all the other things that kind of go on in mid to late August. It's going to be good for the PGA Championship. You're going to see higher TV ratings, you're going to see more interest in that event with it being between the Masters and the United States Open. And the PGA Championship has really become an exciting major. I think it's the most underappreciated golf event in golf. I really enjoy watching it and following it. They set up the golf course where a lot of things that can happen. So it's going to be a gigantic positive for the PGA Championship, although who knows what the weather is going to be in Long Island next May, and who knows where it's going to be in Oak Hill in Rochester, New York in a few years. It's going to be interesting, but there are also some venues that are going to open up too because May is a little bit more tolerable in some places than August. So good for the PGA Championship. Undecided whether it's good for the rest of the PGA Tour and the other events that are on the schedule.
I want to talk golf course design for a few moments. There's been a lot of talk about what Augusta National wants to do with 13. They did buy some adjacent property from the Augusta Golf Club, and that does allow them to maybe lengthen the hole out. Right now, I think it's playing 5-10, and you and I both know it's a two-shot hole to get there, although you saw Reed put it on the bank yesterday. Should they tinker too much with that, in your opinion, or does it need to get another 30 yards or so?
Well, first off, if I'm an Augusta Country Club member, I'm doing cartwheels because someone bought that land for that much money, and I can either improve my own course or my equity membership is worth a lot more. So big win for Augusta Country Club members.
And by the way, Augusta Country Club, everybody will tell you, is a great layout.
Yeah, it's one of the 10 best golf courses in Georgia. I've seen parts of it. I'd love to play it or walk it more when I have the time. It's a fabulous golf course, and that's what a lot of people don't understand. If it wasn't next to Augusta National, it would be the best course in a city of that size. So very impressive golf course. Yeah, I'm sure something's going to be done to the 13th hole. Why would you spend that much money to buy that land if you didn't have grandiose plans, whether it was extending the 13th hole or doing something else, maybe putting a 9 more par 3 holes in or more tournament infrastructure? You just don't buy that without a reason. Obviously, Augusta National officials are very coy with what they do, and the hole is nothing like it intended to be played. And when Alistair McKenzie laid that out with the help of Bobby Jones, they probably never envisioned guys hitting 9 irons and 8 irons into it as a par 5. But with that said, it is pretty exciting when you get to 13, 14 and 15 of the Masters, and a guy might be 3 or 4 shots behind, like we saw yesterday with Jordan Spieth and even Ricky Fowler, because those short par fives, what are now short par fives, are there. That really gives players a chance to catch up. And in my mind, 15 under isn't that ridiculous of a winning score. I think 10 under is about the ultimate score for a major championship or even a regular PGA Tour event, but we would have seen less than 15 under had it not rained earlier in the week and had it not rained on Saturday, and the golf course could play a little firmer. I noticed that when I walked around the course Wednesday, Steve. I was down there for the practice round and some meetings and a banquet and got a chance to spend 8 hours on the golf course. It just wasn't playing very firm, and it never really firmed up like it sometimes does during the course of the Masters. So I don't think that it's time to panic and say that Augusta National is being chewed up by professional golfers, but Augusta National members and officials are very protective of that golf course and the scores that people shoot to. So something, in my mind, will eventually be done. Who knows when it'll be done and to what extent?
I think a lot of people, unless you've actually been there, do not understand the change in elevation there, and especially don't understand the undulation of the greens. As you walked it, give everyone at least your perspective as to what both mean in terms of how it plays out in a tournament.
You certainly have to be in good physical shape to play well at Augusta National. It's not an easy walk. With that said, it's a much easier walk in early April than it would be in August or July, Steve. I mean, the humidity has not even come close to reaching its peak there. I actually had a chance a few years ago to play a course near Augusta National named Sage Valley, which was founded by Weldon Wyatt, who is associated with the Walmart family. He built his own dream private course 13 miles from Augusta National because he couldn't be Augusta National member. And I think 8 of us teed off there on a 90-degree August day, and only 3 of us made it to the 18th hole walking. So Augusta National, but my point is that you have to be in good shape to win the Masters. There are a lot of hills. There are a lot of undulations. The greens are the most impressive thing about that golf course. My first time there was last year on the Wednesday, and I didn't have much time to walk it because there was a tornado watch and severe thunderstorms right around the course, and they didn't really let people on for much. I maybe had like an hour and a half to walk it last year, Steve, my first time there, so I didn't really get the feel for it. But I just remember crossing the fifth fairway last week and staring at that green, and that's a hole you don't see a lot on TV. And right. Just the two humps on it and the way it slopes from back to the front. I guess I would be a better writer, Steve, if I could somehow put that into words, or a better speaker. But it's one of those things where until you stand there, you really have no idea. TV doesn't do justice to how severe those greens are. Just think of maybe the most severe green that you have on a course you play a lot at home in central Pennsylvania, and maybe times that by three or four, and that's the average green at Augusta National. So I'm trying to think of holes just in the State College area that would compare, or in the Sunbury or the Williamsport mm-hmm. area, and I can't think of anything that would even compare to the least severe green at Augusta National.
Right. Now, I understand that. Moving forward, you have four major champions right now, all Americans, all under the age of 27. What does that say, if anything, about the current state of the game with some of the players in this country?
Oh, it's in a really good spot. And here's the interesting thing about Tiger Woods. I think when you look at what his legacy is going to be, I think it's going to be the type of players that came after him, Steve. He made golf a more physical game. He made fitness a part of it. He made being in shape part of it. He made it cool to be in golf in a lot of ways. And I think what we're seeing with these Americans that are 30 and under and playing so well, and just the style of golf they play, that's a product of him. Now, I say that, and you look at two of those major championship winners that we're talking about, really Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed play a game that was nothing like the game that Tiger Woods played. They're more cerebral players. Jordan Spieth is maybe the ultimate course manager in golf right now, so he doesn't really play a Tiger style. But then you look at some of the other players that we're talking about. I mean, Brooks Koepka wins the U.S. Open last year at Erin Hills, and he certainly plays a Tiger-like game with the way he drives the ball and some of the angles he takes. He obviously is nowhere near as consistent as Tiger was in his prime, and Justin Thomas plays a Tiger Woods-like game. But there's so many different ways to succeed in golf, and American golf is in a great spot. And I would also say that European golf is in a great spot right now, too, Steve. Maybe not with the youth movement that there is in America, but you look at all the Europeans that are playing well and having good seasons, and I think you know what I'm getting at, that there is an event coming up here in the fall that's going to be super emotional in France, and I think we're really going to see these two sides with a lot of players in good form. And we could talk about the other three majors, and we could talk about the Masters, but I really think the golf event of the year is going to be the Ryder Cup in France, just because of how so many key American players and so many key European players are off to fabulous starts this year.
Yeah, I agree. I think that will be the golf event of the year. And again,
it's during football season.
Yeah, it's during football season. But I mean, look, Reed and McIlroy being paired up yesterday goes back to Hazeltine. I mean, and Reed, that's where the Captain America thing came out. But the ferocity with which he played, again, he is a great closer. To me, that is the single best attribute of his game.
I think people were making a lot of it being like what happened in Hazeltine in 2016. It did not have that electricity for a couple of reasons. Obviously, Rory didn't play well, but you look at the crowd at Augusta National, they're called patrons, right? They're not spectators. There's a certain decorum that has to be upheld when you attend an event at the Masters. If there's people seriously walking the course, making sure that everybody follows that decorum. And if you don't follow that decorum, you're escorted off the grounds and you never get the opportunity to visit again. So I knew it wasn't going to have that Ryder Cup-like feel because of where they were playing it. And that never really came across on TV, too, because just the Masters broadcast is so much different than a Ryder Cup broadcast because of the camera angles, and they don't have on-course reporters and where some of the microphones are put. So I think my point is that a Reed McIlroy final pairing would have been more fun at Shinnecock Hills with the New York City golf crowd, or PGA Tour event, or the Ryder Cup. I think Augusta National, just because of what it is and kind of what it stands for, we were never going to get the electricity that people were predicting Saturday night when this pairing became finalized.
Yeah, ask Sergio about Bethpage Black.
Yeah, or ask... any tour player about a TPC Scottsdale or PGA National or some of these rowdy crowds. And I personally like them. I think it's fun when
they do
into it on TV. Sometimes you don't feel that electricity at the Masters because the crowd just isn't as electric as the crowds at other tour stops or other major championships. I certainly think that decorum should be part of golf, but I also think a little rowdiness is good for golf too. And some of that, like the Masters, just doesn't play as well on TV as some of the other intense majors, at least in my opinion, because you don't have that electricity or the fan interaction with the players.
Yeah, one final note on that. First hole, Masters, Jason Day hits a drive into the trees. The ball falls into a patron's beer cup, and the beer cup, by the way, is full. Fan is told that Day must ID the ball and then play it. And in the spirit of the day, the fan chugs the beer down and the crowd gives him a standing ovation.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would do the same thing. But
hey,
and
no,
one thing
I
about
wouldn't.
The Masters, could you imagine if the Masters permitted a little more rowdiness and a typical tour-like crowd? I mean, beers are only $4 or $5. Could you imagine if it had the vibe of a tour event? What type of crowd player interactions we would see? It's probably good that beer is like $8, $9, $10, $11, $12 at other tour events, because you really could have some bad situations.
Greater Hartford Open, TPC Scottsdale, you bet. Guy, always a pleasure. It's great to hear from you, my friend. I hope everything's going really well for you. You deserve it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and I hope everybody in central Pennsylvania is enjoying that golf weather today.
It's snowing right now. Thanks.
All right. Talk to you later, Steve.
Thanks, Guy. Guy Cipriano, Golf Industry Magazine. Matt Leon, final half hour as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by our good friends at Purdy Insurance.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by our good friends at Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Purdy's have served this valley for decades. They are the insurance experts. And not only the insurance experts, but they really care about their customers. Your reputation is everything. Your integrity is everything. So they want to make sure that their customers get the right insurance, whether it happens to be auto, home, life, business. The insurance that covers you. They also want to make sure that they do everything they can, turn over every rock they can, to find you the best price. And if there's a claim, they jump in as if it happened to them. They're your partners in this. You need to have a great insurance agency. And that's Purdy Insurance. Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. And I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. All right. In Philadelphia, some great things have been happening. Eagles won the Super Bowl. Villanova won the national championship, and now the Sixers have won 50 games, and they're going to be home for the opening round of the playoffs. They're a good basketball team. With that, we bring in Matt Leon from KYW in Philadelphia. Matt, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Sixers, 50 wins. They'll be at home in the opening round of the playoffs. Matt, what really has come together? Is just the fact that key guys began to play like Ben Simmons? How did it happen?
I just think it's a team playing with a supreme level of confidence. And what's really amazing is, you know, other than Cleveland, they haven't faced a lot of really good teams here down the stretch, but they've won the last six without Joel Embiid.
Right.
And they have looked really good doing it. I just think you've got a team that believes in each other, believes in head coach Brett Brown. And you mentioned Ben Simmons. He is just playing. You know, usually your rookies kind of hit the wall around this time of the year, and he's kind of going the opposite. He's actually taking his game to another level. I think he almost maybe feels some responsibility with Embiid out to take his game to the next level. And, you know, this is a guy that flirts with a triple-double now every game. And it has helped. I mean, it was a big win over Cleveland that they had last week. But they have also played a lot of the dregs of the league. But to their credit, I mean, they just dismissed these teams. Like, they didn't play great yesterday against Dallas. You know, at the center, but that was also a game you never thought they were going to lose. they were able to keep Dallas at an arm's length. I would expect the same thing tomorrow night when they take on a terrible Atlanta Hawks team. It's really fun to watch right now.
What do you think of Markelle Fultz?
I think you're starting to see some real flashes of the number one overall pick. I think the shot is still a work in progress and probably will be. But as kind of the guy making it go on that second unit, he's done a really good job, explosive to the basket, really good, penetrating off the dribble, a lot to like there. And really, I think anything he's given is a bonus, because I think a lot of people a month ago didn't think we'd see him at all. So the fact that he's now pretty firmly entrenched with that second team is a really, really good thing. It just that's one of the things that's kind of happened with this group all of a sudden is they're incredibly deep now. I mean, T.J. McConnell, who's gotten a ton of minutes this year and has been really good as the backup point guard, like, basically didn't play yesterday against Dallas. You know, he got in garbage time in the last couple minutes because Fultz has taken those minutes. And now you throw Marco Bellinelli, what he's meant, off the bench, Ersan Ilyasova coming back. They can really run two full units at you. And obviously there is drop-off, but not the drop-off you usually have in the NBA from your first to your second group. So it's really come together here. I think Sam Hinkie was asked, a former general manager who kind of started this whole thing known as the process, how will you know when it worked? And he said, you'll know it when you see it. Well, I think we know what he was talking about now.
Yeah, exactly. But they've also had contributions, like a guy like Covington, for example. I mean, they've needed some people with Embiid out where it's been a domino effect. Much have they been helped, as you mentioned, Redick and obviously McConnell, but a guy like Covington.
Yeah, Robert Covington has really been here since Jump Street for this rebuild, and he's kind of the guy nobody talks about. He's not the flashy, young star of a Simmons or an Embiid or even a Fultz, and he's not the veteran that's got the name recognition of a J.J. Redick or something like that. But he is integral to what they do defensively. He is a phenomenal defender with a great wingspan. He can shoot the three. I've always said about Covington, when the Sixers win their first playoff series, Covington will be the MVP, because he's the type of guy you can't account for. And you're so worried about Embiid, you're so worried about Simmons, you're so worried about Redick, that Covington doesn't get the respect he deserves, and he's the one that hits three dagger threes in the fourth quarter of Game 6. I think he has the potential to be that type of guy in the postseason.
Which then brings us to the next part. When I asked you maybe a couple years ago, I brought this up, how are the fans handling this? Well, obviously there's been a payoff, but you told me that the fans never really left these guys. Not that there was a total belief, but that, they love basketball in Philadelphia, so they kept going.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, people respected the fact that what they were trying to do. I mean, that they were honest with people, like, we're going to try to do this right. We're not going to try to, they kind of acknowledge that, getting the eighth spot in the conference, losing in the first round and drafting 14th every year, you're not going to do what you have to do to get to that next level. And conversely, free agents aren't going to want to play here, or at least the guys that could change your franchise. So you're just kind of constantly running in place. I think people respected the fact that, basically Sam Hinkie said, we're going to back the truck up, we're going to strip it down, we're going to give ourselves as much chance as possible to get the types of transcendent players we need to get here. And they were on board with it. Now, it didn't go over well with the media, and they weren't drawing a lot of crowds. You could get tickets for $3 on StubHub the night of the game and stuff like that. But I honestly think that for as terrible as those teams were, the Sixers were the second most talked about team in the city, behind the Eagles. I mean, far behind the Eagles, but still, the second most talked about team in the city. And so people believed in this. And I think you look around at a lot of these franchises that are trying rebuild, and they get a couple years along, and then they trade everybody, and they never get any good. I think people appreciate it, and it also helped to have a guy like Brett Brown as the face of it.
I was about to ask you that. I was about to ask you that. I've felt the whole time they've had the right guy. Does this confirm it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that helped a lot, too, is Brett Brown was honest with people. At press conferences, he would, tell you what was happening and stuff like that. you didn't hear much from the front office, and really you still don't, but Brett Brown's out there every day, and he's a guy I think a fan base, they trust, and they trust was the right hire at the time. The wins and losses, you know, it was tough, but now all of a sudden you see it, and it's really cool to see Brett Brown now at the podium after game.
Yeah.
And he's really kind of just beaming. I hope there's some pride within himself for what he's able to weather and what he's helped put together here. But there's genuine pride, I think, for a lot of these players that have what they've accomplished to this point. And they're an elite team now.
Yes,
this is not a, you know, you don't look at this. You don't look at this as a flash in the pan or anything
That's
like
right.
that. You look at this as an ascending team that has taken foothold on that elite level, and there is no reason to think they can't spend the next 5 or 6 years in this 50-win category and as a team no one wants to face in the postseason.
Mm-hmm. Because right now, the Celtics and the Sixers are the two young teams maturing. The older teams are starting to get older.
Yeah.
And there's going to be attrition.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think we've hit the top of the bell curve with this group yet. Like they're still getting better. They're still kind of I don't want to say figuring it out. That's not what I mean, but they're still very young, and they're going to continue to improve. And you know, while they're getting there, oh by the way, they're winning 50 games, they're winning 14 in a row, and they're getting home court in the first round of the playoffs. So it's really, really fun to watch.
And then the next part, I'll just flip this over now for 1 second to the Phillies. We talked about Brett Brown, where even in the darkest times, you said, you know what, the guy knows what he's doing. He knows how to coach, right? I think all of us have said that about him. What kind of learning curve is Gabe Kapler on right now?
Well, I'll tell you what, I was at the home opener on Thursday, and I don't know that I've ever heard not just a Phillies manager, but a manager get booed as much as he got booed when he took Nick Pivette out of the game in the sixth inning. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just rained down from the stands. And I think that was kind of a retroactive booing for opening day when he took Aaron Nola out that, you know, has been well discussed. I look at it, I think ever since opening day, there's only one thing, and I think they were wrong to take Nola out of the game, and it cost them the game. And then, I don't know if it was the second or the third game where he forgot or no one told Hobie Milner to warm up and they tried to put him in the game. I've never seen that before. That's egregious.
Right.
I've never seen that before. I've never seen that in Legion Ball. Like, I've never seen that anywhere.
I haven't seen that at any level.
No, where they try to put a pitcher in that's not warmed up to the point where the umpire has to step in for the good of the player and tell the opposing manager, look, I know they screwed up, but I'm not letting this guy get hurt. Somebody's got to care about him. Other than that, I don't think, I think it's been pretty steady. I know some people have problems with some of the defensive shifts they do. I think those things are done for a reason, and they're done because of what the numbers dictate, and you will win on those more often than not, but it's not foolproof. It's going to be interesting. I think the big problem was pulling Nola out opening day like that and then losing the game. It just kind of set things up that for all eyes to be on him, given how out of the box a hire he was. If they had still won that game, or if he had just let Nola finish the inning and they still won that game, I think the heat would be turned way down, because I think even the thing with Milner, as egregious as it was, it would have been a footnote if it happened on its own, but it built off the narrative of opening day, and it really started to turn into a feeding frenzy. So, you know, we'll see. If they win, it's really going to be like Bull Durham, you know, when Nuke LaRoche talks about the fungus on the shower, or Crash Davis talks about the fungus on the shower sheet, you know, right now. You know, you go ahead and win 20 in the show, people will say you're colorful. Right now, you're a slob. Well, right now, people think he's a slob. And we'll see if the fungus is allowed to grow back.
You want to know the difference between being flamboyant and being a jerk? Winning.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the
absolutely.
Difference.
So, you know, if the first 6 or 7 game-winning streak the Phillies put together, I think a lot of this will go away. I do think Kapler's handled it well in the fact that he had the press conference after the home opening. He was asked about being booed, and he just talked about, I'm going to work really hard for these fans so they know that I'm in this. I think it was a perfect answer.
Yes,
it was the perfect antidote for for all of that. And, you know, you win a couple games and the long slog of a baseball season takes over. I think he'll be fine, but I do think we will have more a couple more moments like this of well, that's interesting type of decisions.
Who's the one quick question though? I was going to let you go, but I want to get this one. Who's the bench coach?
Rob Thompson, who came from the Yankees.
He's very highly regarded. Very highly regarded. I mean, that's a guy that in certain areas he's got to lean on a little bit. I mean,
That's what I think. That decision of not having Milner up, while Kapler is at the head of the decision making, that's a staff-wide failure. Because somebody's got to step up and say, "Whoa, Gabe, he's not ready. He hasn't. Nobody called down there." And so, I spread the blame out. But you know, when you're the manager, you're going to take the bullets. So,
but just knowing for because Alex Cora was the bench coach down in Houston. Brad Mills was the bench coach for Terry Francona. All those, some of these guys are really, really good at what they do. And Robbie Thompson certainly is somebody that would be in that category.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, no question about it.
Matt, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Matt Leon, KYW in Philadelphia. Back with more in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Purdy Insurance. All right, great to have you with us. You know, I keep hearing the commercials from Erica Shames for Susquehanna Life Magazine 25th anniversary. Don't you think in 25 years about time that there's a full cover feature on the suit? But there's no response. But,
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that one.
it's just fascinating where he is in life. I don't mean to tell Erica how to do her job, but you know, I think it would be. Well, he probably would kill the magazine. All right, so we don't want that to happen. We like Susquehanna Life Magazine, so. We can't hurt. I wouldn't even do a back page feature on him. All right, so.
Hey, by the way, Steve, did you see Returno yet? I was curious to get your take if you had seen it.
No, and nor will I. I have no interest in seeing it at all.
Okay.
I don't really need Barry Levinson and Al Pacino to tell me about somebody I knew. So.
Just curious.
No need. Ratings results. The new ESPN show, Get Up, is staggering right now with the ratings. Okay? They had SportsCenter in that spot. And Get Up is getting 246 million viewers, down 24.2% from SportsCenter.
That's not surprising. Considering the talent they have on that show, besides Greeny,
it's like it's interesting.
I mean, really, are you serious? Michelle Beadle and Jalen Rose with Mike Greenberg, who's one of your best broadcasters on there. Are they serious? That show's a joke.
I don't know. I haven't seen it yet.
I've watched bits and pieces of it here and there, but it's just how can they think of that pairing? It just makes zero sense to me.
Well, what's interesting is that First Take, which is down 8% from a year ago.
So no shocker there either.
But they go all the way up from 246,000 viewers. It should be 200. I think I said 246 million was wrong. 246,000 viewers up to 379,000 when First Take starts. Let's see. The number one rated show last week on ESPN was the Notre Dame Mississippi State women's basketball game.
As it should have been. That was great theater, great drama.
The fifth highest rated show on ESPN2 last week was the NIT championship game.
How about that?
Penn State and Utah. Very, very good.
But seriously, though, ESPN. Man, they have gone so downhill with their programming.
They put a lot of money into this. They've got a lot of money in salaries in this with Mike Greenberg, Michelle Beadle, and Jalen Rose. Salary-wise, I read one report where it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $14 to $15 million a year just on the salaries for the three of them.
That's atrocious.
Now, all credit to the three individuals for making that kind of money.
Of course.
All credit to them. I would never want to disparage anybody.
Right, absolutely.
But that also means they've got to make it back somewhere, too, and then some. For news.